Blog Talk Radio.
When a parent lashes out at the other parent in front of a child, or simply says hurtful things about the other parent in front of a child, they are also attacking that child's sense of self-worth and confidence.
Dad says Mom doesn't really care about me and that she's lazy.
This is an act of alienation and is harmful to children and can cause a lifetime of issues for the child. Issues as serious as anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and thoughts of or actual suicide.
What should I do to make Mommy and Daddy so mad at each other?
Whether or not your child reaches his or her full and healthy potential in life rests in your ability to be mature and put them first.
I love you, Mom and Dad.
Help spread the word to educate and raise awareness. Visit www.paawareness.org to find out more.
Definitely visit our website. This is Jill Agisi, and welcome to Family Matters. I am here tonight with my wonderful, beautiful co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, Jill. It's great to. It's always great and illuminating to do this, especially.
Well, I feel like I haven't talked to you for so long. I've been gone, and I feel like we haven't talked too much. Just one quick conversation in the last 8 days is not enough for me to be awake.
Well, you know, it's a big deal when you bring the message nationally, Jill. So I got to tell people, because your listeners really follow what you do. They need to know that you were just on Dr. Phil. They need to know for a lot of reasons. One, because it means that your book is finally reaching out in the hearts so that it can get national presence. Everybody who's involved in the alienation movement just got a huge boost as a result of your efforts. So,
well, thanks, Michelle. Thank
I know you,
you
don't
I
know
think...
when it's on yet, but everybody's got to stay tuned, and we'll let you know, and keep listening, and we'll give you the date when it's out.
We absolutely will, and it is what you say is so important. To create awareness nationally and globally is such an important thing for what we do, the parental alienation issue, for keeping people from being in an adversarial divorce position. We want children to be healthy and happy and have wonderful lives with both parents. And so I'm just going to work until I die to make that happen for kids all around the world.
Or die in the process.
I'm going to die. No, I feel that passionate about it, though.
Yeah.
I want kids to be happy, and so I'm just going to churn away here in Springfield, Illinois, and wherever I am. But thank you for mentioning that. You know, along those lines, tonight I have to say I found this wonderful woman, Deborah Moskovich, who's with us tonight. Welcome, Deborah.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for coming and being with us tonight. And I found her kind of in a weird way. I don't even remember how it happened. I stumbled on Deborah. She's in Canada. And of course, Parental Alienation Awareness Organization is based out of Toronto. And I don't know how that all happened, but in the interim, Ruthie DiTucci, who has Syndicated News, had been talking to Deborah and said, you should be on some show. And I had already had Deborah booked on our show. And so it worked out. It was kismet, you know, so it all
and
worked out really
that,
well.
Not only that, but Martha Chan emails me. She is the publisher of Divorce Magazine and says, Michelle, you've got to know Deborah. You guys need to know each other. And I said, funny thing, we're going to get Jill and I are going to interview her on Wednesday. So that just happened. So Martha says, oh.
That is so neat. It was absolutely meant to be. And so, Deborah, you have written this book, The Smart Divorce. Is there a smart divorce?
Well, I didn't have one. But absolutely there is a smart divorce, and that is keeping your emotions outside of the divorce process, dealing with them through therapy or however it is that you need to manage your emotions, and dealing with the legal process specifically on the facts, not bring in the agenda of revenge, shame, blame, and everything else. Because, Jill, as you mentioned at the opening of the show, I mean, what you really want to do, and one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is that I had three young children when I left my marriage. They were 1, 3, and 7. And I didn't want them walking around with a chip on their shoulder, considering themselves as children of divorce, I wanted them to think of themselves as just regular kids. So that, you know, like that was one other thing, one thing. And secondly, when I started to rebuild my life and I was meeting lots of wonderful people, I found that they were walking around bitter and angry. You know, it's the walking wounded and the emotionally scarred. And I didn't want to be like that either. So as I started to research what made divorce so difficult for individuals and helping them to rebuild their life post-divorce and why they were so angry, I decided that I needed to write this book, The Smart Divorce, to find out why people couldn't move on. And, you know, there's so many different things. And that's about being smart about divorce, is making your decisions based on facts, not the emotional agenda. Because what happens is, you know, there are people that, and I've got a private divorce consulting practice now, and I've got clients coming in and say, you know, I just want this over with, and they walk away, and they say that they want to walk away from it all, but then 2 years later, they've got no money, and then they're bitter and angry that they walked away from it all. Or the people that spend thousands of dollars fighting over something that the value is really minuscule, so that if they did a cost-benefit analysis, they would have realized that it wasn't worth the battle. So
you just said so many things, so I want to loop back into one of the things that's of great importance to me, and this is people not moving on.
Yeah.
People have, the wounds have closed, but they have not necessarily healed. And even though people seem to think that they have put all of that, those damaging emotions in cold storage, really they're beneath the surface, sabotaging them. So why do you think that people hang on and can't move on like they should?
Great question, and I think that there are a number of things. First of all, they feel that they're a victim, and they can't let go of that victim mentality. So they're not doing the emotional heal. And I believe that if you don't acknowledge the emotions that you experience while going through divorce, it catches up with you later on. So that's one of the things that's happening. Secondly, you know, like people go through the divorce process with unrealistic objectives. So if they think that they're going to gain a windfall, for instance, in support payments or, you know, alimony, because they led a really luxurious life during the marriage, but really that was funded by debt, you know, it was funded by a line of credit or family gifts, and they didn't end up with that lifestyle because really they couldn't afford it during the marriage. So it's the unrealistic objectives, and then they're sorry. There's another factor is that you gain your identity. Oftentimes, many people gain their identity as a couple and who they were in the marriage, and then they lose that, and they don't know how to rebuild who they are.
Deborah, I love when you, in your book, and it may be people who haven't read the book, I want to tell them the book is a lot of vignettes from different attorneys and people from the mental health field that weigh in and give their two cents, for lack of a better word. And I love that you get all of the different perspectives. But one of them that I especially liked was this one. I knew a judge who once, when he was about to render his decision, told the divorcing couple, "I hope you did not come to court this morning expecting me to give you anything. I have nothing to give you. Whatever you came to court with, you will leave with less. You would be better served going back out into the hallway and reaching a settlement on your own." What words of wisdom those are. And Judge Lawrence, I know that you feel that same way, don't you?
I'll be honest with you. I don't think that heartbreak and the breaking up and disintegration of families belong standing under glaring fluorescent lights under a American flag with people terrified. I don't think that's how you break up the heartbreak of families. I think that's the last way to do it. And I think every other way under the sun would probably be better than turning over your power to a court so that a judge who only has a snapshot of who you are changes your life. Now, we take it very seriously, and we want to be good. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people keeping their own power, which is why I like Deborah's book so much, because that's the recipe for that. I write about it. She writes about it. Different voice, same heart, same effect. You know, really effective. No, they don't belong in the courts. People should do everything in the world to try and reach settlement. whether it's, and hopefully Deborah will tell everybody the difference between arbitration, mediation, and collaborative. People really need to become comfortable with these options, and then lawyers can get you hooked up with those options as well. So maybe we should talk about the difference in those and what coaching does, you know.
Well, you've raised so many really good points, because what I found when I personally went through the divorce process is it doesn't matter who made the decision. People have no clue what it is they're about to experience. I didn't really even understand the nuances in negotiation. And, you know, I'm a smart person. So can you imagine then for most people going through the divorce process, no matter who made that decision, what are the differences between all the different dispute resolutions? And what is the end result? So if you want to mediate, obviously you're going to have a more amicable resolution than if you litigate or arbitrate. So let me talk about like the differences. And what's interesting is I had a client just last week who came to my office and said, I just want to arbitrate this and get it over with. And I said, do you know what arbitration is? It's a judge making that decision for you. He said, but you're not going to court. And of course, you're not going to court, but somebody is making that decision for you. You're losing control. So when you talk about the dispute resolutions and what are the alternatives, you know, you have to look at what your life, what you want out of the divorce process. I mean, Judge Lawrence, you know that there is definitely a place for court. You know, in certain instances, you have no choice but to go to court and fight it out. I mean, that's the unfortunate reality. But there are cases where you can have a very amicable parting, you know, by negotiation, by mediation, using a neutral third party to help the couple arrive at the decision together, and give them different options that they hadn't thought of before. Collaborative law, which was very interesting, it was established by Stu Webb, who's in Minneapolis, and I think he invented that in the 1990s. He went to court and he lost his best friend because of the dueling lawyers. And he decided that divorce did not belong in court and it should be the option of the clients to arrive at a resolution based on needs, not on what is their, based on needs, not on rights. And I thought that was beautiful because people then are more likely to settle. They're settlement-oriented. So collaborative law really is you're signing an agreement that you're not going to go to court. And if there is a breakdown, then the lawyers are off that file and you have to retain new legal counsel. So,
which is the downside for some people.
Yes, it is.
And it clearly is. I could see something of a hybrid where people make this pact to not go to court, and if it does break down, there's a way you could still use the lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it would be a hybrid, but, you know, it would be cost-effective on some level.
I agree. And I think what you have to do is seek for a lawyer that's settlement-oriented. You know, not a lawyer that's just a gladiator and that's just happy to take it to court, but someone who really wants to settle. But one of the positives in collaborative law, but you could use that in other, you know, you don't have to go to a collaborative lawyer, is that if the couple can't communicate, you know, you bring in a divorce coach or you bring in other professionals
or
like
a therapist.
Or a therapist to help the couple through the divorce process and neutral third parties. I mean, maybe that's a way. Like I suggest to my clients all the time to bring in a parenting expert to help them develop the parenting plan. You know, why should you have a lawyer do that for you when a parenting expert, such as a parenting coordinator or whomever it is that you're bringing in, that's their area of expertise. So I think that's something that's really important.
I like collaborative. I think it's a huge value because, it acknowledges that really divorce is very rarely about the law.
Yeah.
And that's everybody needs to know that. Sometimes there's straight-up legal issue, but that's not the problem.
Employ that in every state, though, in the United States, and you're in Canada, Deborah. So how do you handle that there?
Oh, collaborative law. You can hire collaborative lawyers in Ireland. Collaborative law has become very popular around the world. I mean, not every country has collaborative law, but many countries do have lawyers now who are trained specifically in collaborative law. I actually did the collaborative law training. So I've learned a lot about it. And it's a mindset that the lawyers need to go through
right.
to understand what's in the best interest of their clients. Because, again, it's what the client needs versus what's entitled to, what they're entitled to. And, you know, this was a great example of what was explained to me by one of the collaborative lawyers here in Toronto. And that was, you can say you've got a mother who is very concerned about her child support dollars and a father who wants more time with his children. So it's a balancing act. So the mother says, of course, you can have the children as much time as you want. Let's come up with an agreement that we can both work on. And the father says, okay, that's fine. You'll still maintain those child support dollars, because what you find is that people are fighting over a formula, right, Judge Lawrence? Don't you see that?
Yes, it's a good example.
So people are afraid to give up extra time with their children because they're afraid of losing out on child support dollars, when in fact, if you look at what each party really needs, then there's more flexibility.
Well, the reason I like your example is because in collaborative or mediation or the two parties working it out, you could take a scenario like that and have the father doing the child care.
Yeah.
It's the nuance you're talking about.
Yeah.
Judges,
well, and I like that, Michelle, when you talk about in your courtroom, you try to make the parents feel as if they're invested in the plan that they're coming up with. And I like that when you talk about how you try to get them to split up duties and invest in their child's lives. And I think when you make them feel that you feel that they're part of the plan and you're investing in their future, then they make better decisions. Do you think?
If they have a voice in their agreement, they are much more likely to adhere to it.
Right.
If a judge shoves it down their throat, they will have a resistance to it forever. Why wouldn't they? Who wouldn't? It's like being forced into some surgery you don't want. You're going to resent it. And you're not going to feel like you have created the traction of your own life. So I'm sorry, Deborah. Go ahead.
I think you make a really good point, because the thing is that a judge is a stranger, and no one knows their children better than you. So if you feel that you know what's best for your children, if you and your partner can figure out what's best for your children and mediate that or come to some kind of agreement outside of the courtroom, isn't that much better for the family in the long run?
You know, when people are frightened, which they are, of this system, they're frightened of being alone, as you pointed out, frightened of loss of identity. When you're frightened, you do want somebody to protect you. So most people tend to offload their power and look for somebody who looks powerful to them.
Mm-hmm.
And who looks powerful to them is their lawyer. Who looks powerful to them is the judge. And when you give up your power to someone else, it's completely disempowering to you.
Yeah.
The kinds of things we're talking about with the collaborative and the media is a way to maintain power, even when you're terrified. You get a lawyer. Your lawyer is going to look over your agreement. Your lawyer is still going to protect you, but you're keeping your hand in the recipe of how your life is coming out. So let's say that people are open to these options. Deborah, could you give us some idea about the most terrifying thing, which is choosing the lawyer, going to a divorce lawyer for the first time, revealing your personal story and, you know, all your confidences, and then trying to weigh in the trauma of your family breaking down how to pick the right person?
Okay. Well, first of all, you feel so many people are embarrassed. I think we sort of need to change that, the societal views on divorce. There's nothing embarrassing about going through divorce. So you feel judged because all of a sudden you are like morsels of juicy gossip amongst your peers, right?
Here.
So then you go into a lawyer's office, and oftentimes people have never worked with a lawyer before. Maybe if they bought a house, you know, that's their initial workings with a lawyer. But to work with a family law lawyer who is going to help you make life-altering decisions is quite daunting. So when I counsel my clients in terms of to look for a lawyer, we talk about so many different things, because I think you need to have honesty. You need to be able to really tell your lawyer your story, even if you have a bad fact situation. And oftentimes people are afraid that they're going to be judged, that they can't be honest, and then that can work against you. So I recommend that people at least go see three lawyers so that they know and they feel comfortable and there's some kind of sense of chemistry in terms of who that person is. Because people all search for different things. If you are it all depends on the personality type. You know, there are some lawyers that will kind of hold your hand and take you through the process very slowly. There are other lawyers that are very matter-of-fact. You know, there's certain personality types. So a lawyer that was right for one person might not necessarily be right for the other person. So when you're looking in the when you're going through a consultation, it's so important to write down all the questions that you have for a lawyer. So, for instance, if you are going through a certain situation, if there was domestic violence, if there was certain financial issues, you need to ask a lawyer, how are they going to handle that? What's their strategy? And I think it's so important to go into a lawyer's office informed of all the things that you need to address. So you should really do that research before you go in. Another thing that can help alleviate some of the concern and give you a little bit of control is understanding your finances prior to going into a lawyer's office so that you can get some information from that lawyer in terms of what your rights and entitlements are. And then that gives you some leeway to evaluate whether or not you feel comfortable working with that lawyer in terms of how they're advising you.
Deborah, I want to just stop you for a second, but I want you to remember where you are chronologically in this
okay.
in this whole scheme of things. It seems that I talk to very many women, and I'm on the board of the Weitzman Center in Chicago, which deals with middle to upper class women who have been stay-at-home moms, who have never had jobs, who've never been involved in finances at all, don't know even who pays their electric bill for their home, don't see that. They fill their car with gas, it gets filled, that's how it happens. No bills going through the household at all. So you don't know what your finances are, and now they're locked in, if you're married to a lawyer or a doctor or whoever, they're locked in that office and you can't get to them. What do you do in that situation when you're that kind of mom or wife? And you've never even balanced your checkbook. And that might be extreme, but there are women out there like that.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And that's what we call the uninformed spouse. There are many women out there who have given up any financial responsibility during the marriage. And you really need to take the time now to understand your finances. So what I suggest to my clients, and I talk about this quite extensively in The Smart Divorce, is you fill out a financial statement. So get that, it's really easy to find that too. If you just Google financial statements or you go into a legal firm website, oftentimes you can pull off the financial statement to fill out. And if you look at every little financial thing that you need to fill out, like, you know, your household expenses. So how much, try to figure out a month on how much you spend on grooming. How much do you spend on groceries? Like, start at the basics. Go through your Visa statements. If you can get a hold of your Visa statements, really understand where your money is coming from. There are many women then who, because they're the uninformed spouse and don't have any control over the finances, they have no credit rating. So now I think is a time to start developing your credit rating. So what you should do is open up your own bank account. You know, go to the bank, set up your own credit card if you can, your own bank account statement, and start getting involved in paying off your bills. So try to understand, take responsibility in terms of what the household expenses look like. Where's the money coming from? How's it going out? Because you need to know at the end of the day, can you balance your checkbook?
Well, you're not advocating cutting back on grooming, are you?
Absolutely.
But that would be the first time I'm going to disagree with you, because
no,
if you're getting a divorce, you got to upgrade the grooming.
Absolutely.
Right, you got to have the mani and the pedi, or it's not going to work out for you.
But
at
what
all.
I'm saying is, I think you need to understand how much money a month are you spending on your grooming? How much money a month are you spending on your groceries? How much money are you spending on your children? How
but
much
I
money
guess,
are you spending
I
on
guess,
gas?
You know, The worst thing, though, is, and having been in this very position and speaking to this now after I think back about it, how stupid it was, the first thing I thought I should do was get an American Express card because I knew that was good. So I did that, and they gave me one, which I was surprised about. But you know, these people, these women are having this emotional issue, they're having the legal issue, and then on top of that, they've got this whole other kind of I don't know what's going on issue that they have to deal with, and it's very, very scary because you don't know where your next check to put in your bank account is coming from.
Right. You know what? That's a good point, because one of the things that happens to people going through the divorce process is fear. They're full of fear. So I feel very strongly that you need to address those fears and work with the right professional. So, Jill, you brought up a really good point. Like, if you don't know where that money's coming from, how to balance your checkbooks, why don't you work with a financial planner? There are individuals that are trained specifically in the finances of divorce.
Divorce math is the new word that they're using. But it's a really good phrase. But, you know, the problem is it's one reality too harsh for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But I suggest to the people who don't have the stomach for really doing that balance that the worst part is the fear that you can't make it as an ongoing thing without the reality of how short or how okay you are. It's tedious. And here's the thing with the paperwork that you're talking about. It's the last thing anybody, male, female, wants to do when they're going through their private hell is sit there and start pulling out old papers. We're all, you know, tax filing adverse to begin with.
Yeah.
But the thing is, letting it linger is far more painful than putting in a couple of weekends, taking your phone off the hook and getting it done. Because once you get that paperwork done, I'm telling you, you will start to relax a little bit. It's when you let it loom that it bleeds energy from you.
Right. And that's a great point. So that, you know, divorce is hugely emotional. So you want to feel in control of your life at the beginning of the process. You know, as much as you can, you need to start gaining control. So like you said, if you just earmark a couple of weekends towards doing that financial balance sheet, pulling it all together, you'll feel empowered. Like, you feel really good that, this is one thing that I can cross off that checklist, and now I can move on to the next point.
So let's go back, because Jill wanted to earmark going back to choosing
right.
an attorney.
Yeah.
I'm of the belief that every client should have no less than a one-hour discussion with their attorney about how they bill and what they bill for, so that the lawyer has the opportunity to say to him, if you're angry and you want to go to court because he broke your china set, it's going to cost you. You really want to, I mean, everybody's afraid to talk about money. People are much more comfortable talking about sexual positions than they are talking about their attitudes towards money. So a lot of people don't talk to their clients, and a lot of clients don't ask all the questions. They're dying to know. I think they should say, will you put an hour aside for me, Madam Attorney, Mr. Attorney, and we talk about nothing but billing.
I think that's excellent.
How do you feel? I mean, isn't that because ultimately the bill comes, the client has a sticker shock and feels even worse about the whole process?
Well, that's a great point, because how many people complain about their lawyers overcharging them? And so if you understood that one 10-minute phone call is cheaper than 10 one-minute phone calls, you know, that's
right.
Part of the billing process is how does your lawyer pull that bill together? I mean, every time you pick up your phone and call a lawyer, that's going to cost you. Doesn't matter what you talk to the lawyer about. If it's 5 minutes, you're still getting charged for 10. That's critical. And that's why you need to do that cost-benefit analysis when you just talked about that battle. Because how much is that going to cost you? Like, I had a client that spent $10,000 over a $3,000 grand piano. I mean, at the end of the day, both parties could have had a beautiful $5,000 grand piano. So Billings is critical. And also, you know, you need to review your statement, because I remember going through my divorce. You can ask your lawyer, is there not a mistake on my statement? Because I remember
you absolutely
that there was an extra zero. Or you can fight over something. Like, I remember going to court, and the lawyer wanted to send a junior lawyer, but wanted to charge me for that junior lawyer getting up to speed on my file. And I didn't feel comfortable about that. I said, you know, if you don't want to be there, that's fine, but I shouldn't have to pay someone within your firm to get up to speed. So you really have to advocate for yourself and try to really understand what you're being charged for.
I think that's so important, Deborah, that you point that out, because people have the impression that lawyers cannot be challenged, cannot be called on the carpet for mistakes that they've made, and they absolutely can. It's just like a doctor. I mean, they put on their pants the same way we do, and they are just people, and they make mistakes, and their billing people make mistakes. So always go over that bill with a fine-tooth comb and make sure that you know what's going on.
Right. And, you know, and that goes back to Judge Lawrence's point about the billing. Like, how does that work? And how can I cut down on my billing? So one of the things that I tell my clients is gather up all your questions so that when you go into the lawyer's office, you know exactly what it is that you want to talk about. Because if you don't have an agenda, you know, I think that divorce needs to be handled like a business transaction. Now, it's very difficult because divorce is a very emotional time in your life. But if you really, truly want to try to cut down on your legal bills so that you're not busy paying off your divorce post-divorce, then you really have to look at it from a business perspective. So, you know, document all your questions. Take notes. Do the follow-up. You know, do the homework. And oftentimes people don't follow up in time. You know, they're too overwhelmed. And then they miss the deadline date to respond back, and then that's going to cost them more money longer term because, you know, if they needed some information from the other side and then all of a sudden they don't have that information and now more letters are going back and forth, you know, that kind of thing. I think that people really need to understand what full financial disclosure really means, because if you don't have full financial disclosure, again, that can cost you more money in terms of lawyers' letters going back and forth. And one other point that I want to bring up is a second opinion. If you don't agree with what your lawyer is saying to you, it's okay to go to another lawyer for a second opinion or to call your lawyer up on that piece of advice and say, I don't understand or I don't like it. What's the rationale behind it? I think people sometimes are too intimidated to question the thinking that the lawyer has.
Well, this segues right into how to save money on legal fees.
Yeah.
Some people have all the money and really not interested. We're not exactly speaking to them. We're talking to the people that are really struggling with this. And so it segues into this divorce coach thing. I'm going through a divorce. Instead of me calling a lawyer at $300 or $400 an hour to explain to me why it is that he or she was 2 hours late, why it is they disappeared in the back into a pretrial, and were they selling me out, and all of this stuff, which I'm going to want to talk to my lawyer for hours to vent my fears. I could call up a divorce coach, and you would say, it always happens. They always disappear. That's pretrial. Lawyers are always late. You can navigate the process. Because if you're offloading and you're venting your emotions to a lawyer, when it's the only person you have, it's going to cost you a lot of money.
A lot of money.
I mean, you can go to a therapist. That's a whole other option. But there's the emotional component. There's the legal component. And the emotions should never be the ones making the legal decisions. But they have to go somewhere. And they have to go somewhere smart.
Yeah.
And they have to go somewhere where there's trust. Now, I'd like to know more about the coaching thing, how that differs from therapy, and maybe you could explain it to people, because this is a new phenomenon.
This is very different, and there aren't a lot of people doing it, but if you do want to go to a divorce, like I'm a divorce consultant, so what I do, I'm not a therapist, and I'm not a lawyer, but I understand the divorce process, and people need that education in terms of what it is they're about to experience. So let's start from the beginning. I've got a client that's coming into my office and they're emotionally raw. They don't necessarily think to go to a therapist. So one of the things we do then is I'll refer them to a therapist. How do you find a therapist? And we talk about, you know, different options in therapy. Do you want to go see a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a social worker? There's so many different individuals that you could look at in the mix, and we got to look at your finances. So
how do you pick a therapist?
Well, in Canada, we have psychiatrists that are covered by the medical system. So if you can get a referral to a psychiatrist, that would be wonderful. It has nothing to do with your mental state, but it's covered by what's called OHIP, Ontario Health Insurance. Or, you know, many people have, if they work for a big company, they have an employee assistance program, they can call the EAP division, and they can get referred to a therapist that way, and that cuts down on their costs. So there are lots of different ways. You could even go to a social worker or a therapist and ask if they have a sliding scale. So people don't think necessarily about asking for the sliding scale. They're too embarrassed, but really what's to be embarrassed about? If you need that emotional help and you need to go often, it's very costly. And one of the things that people are so afraid about, and it's a realistic fear, are the finances of divorce and what the financial outlay is going to be. So let's look at what all the alternatives are, what you think it's going to cost, what is the assistance that you need, and earmark funds for every different thing. So that's one thing, is the emotional piece, is getting the right therapy that you need.
But how do you know how to gauge something like that? I mean, whether you connect, because they just sit there and take notes.
Well, okay, so then we can talk. Yes, that's a good point. So what is it that you need? If you need someone that you can really talk through things about, then, you know, it's almost like you need to do your due diligence with a lawyer, do your due diligence with a therapist. You know, you can go to your family doctor and say, I need someone who I can really talk through. So you might not want to go through psychoanalysis because that's where you're lying on the sofa and you truly are lying on a couch and you're talking to a therapist who's just saying, and there is absolutely no face-to-face contact. Well, that's not what you need. So if you want someone who is going to actually tell you what you need to hear, offer their thoughts, help you think things through, you know, you need to talk to individuals who have been through crisis in their life before. Who did they use? How did it work for them? Go to your family doctor. And then with a few different referrals, go see if that individual is the right person for you. Because, again, just like working with a lawyer or working with a therapist, there has to be a great personality fit. If you don't feel comfortable telling your therapist your deep, dark secrets, then your therapy is not going to work.
You're exactly right, Deborah. Now, here's kind of the antithesis of all of that. What if you, and what I said before, what if you're at the other end of the scale where you can't afford, maybe you can just afford a lawyer, mm-hmm. and maybe not a really good one. How do you handle your divorce if you're mid to lower middle class, and what avenue do you pursue then to have the smart divorce if you don't have the funds to do the psychotherapy and the really high-profile attorney? What do you do then?
Well, there are lots of different things, but it's a lot more work. So I think it's critical that you have your support network. So a support network can be clergy. I mean, is your local rabbi, your local priest, whoever it is that you need, are they going to charge you? I don't think so. So, you know, find someone who you hold in high regard to use as your sounding board, you know. So if you go to your local church, your local synagogue, and see what kind of support groups they have. Google divorce support groups. I was just writing about this today. There are a lot of different divorce support groups that you can go to that don't charge you anything. There's an organization, I think, that's across North America, Parents Without Partners. I mean, that's great because you're meeting people in the same situation as you. There's Separated Anonymous. There are so many different groups that you can go to that can offer you that emotional support that you don't have to pay. And
hospital,
you don't have to stay
too.
There either. You know, like if that group does not feel comfortable to you, don't stay there. Maybe you even go to your local library and go to your clergy and say, you know, I want to start my own support group. Can you help me and can you give me the space?
Absolutely. So, I think that's great to be an advocate for yourself in any economic area that you're in is important.
Yeah, so I'm not saying it's easy. It's probably a lot more work. And I think that you really have to do your research. So sometimes a little bit of information can be harmful, but if you really did your research online and came up with lots of questions to ask your lawyer rather than go to your lawyer's office or your attorney's office, you know, and stare blankly at them and say, okay, now tell me what I need to do. If you go there with lots of questions and lots of information, as they say, I know this sounds cliche, but information is knowledge and knowledge is power. So if you know all the questions that you need to ask and you know what's right, what feels comfortable for you, then try to arm yourself with as much information as possible. And that is really critical going through the consultation process, right? Because when you are going to a lawyer's office, and it's something that we talked about earlier, but how do you know if a lawyer is right for you? If you arm yourself with as much information as possible, so you ask them about the billings, you ask them about timing. Like, too many people retain lawyers that don't have the time for their file. So that's one of the first questions you ask. Do you have the time for my file? Who's going to handle the file in your office? Because it's not always the senior lawyer that handles your file throughout. I mean, there are more junior lawyers that might be able to handle something, you know, just as well as the senior lawyer. Filling out the financial statement. You know, if you don't feel comfortable with that, you don't need the senior lawyer to fill that out. Actually, they're probably the legal assistant can fill that out. So there are a lot of different things that you need to do. Going back to talking about, you know, a divorce consultant and what they can do and how they can help you, I mean, like, that's all part of it, is pulling together all those questions and thinking through some of the issues. Because when you're so close to it, right, you don't necessarily think clearly. You don't think about the questions that you need to consider. Let's talk about the kids for a minute. You know, you talk about the parenting plan. What I find is very difficult is people are not often aware of a parenting plan and what the purpose of the parenting plan is and how it can help them and how it actually can reduce the conflict. So if you understand the purpose behind a parenting plan and all the things that you need to incorporate into that parenting plan, it could actually cut down on a lot of stress. It can cut down on legal bills because you're better prepared in terms of what it is that you need to do. If you feel like this is high conflict, then maybe you want to talk about bringing in a parenting coordinator. There's so many different individuals within the divorce process that you can retain, and I know that it sounds expensive, but retaining other individuals other than your lawyer to do certain aspects of the divorce can actually be cheaper in the long run.
Well, you know, one of the agendas... Oh, I'm sorry, Jill, go ahead.
Go ahead, Michelle. No, go ahead. I just want to say, Deborah makes this sound as if it's a job. You know, you have to treat this as if this is your 9-to-5 everyday job so that you can get the result that you want and really be invested in what's going on in your life.
Yeah. It's way more hours than we would like to think, especially if you're working. And you know, one of the agendas, one of our missions on this show is, and one of the following that Jill has as the president of a parent alienation organization,
mm-hmm.
is, can you give any, so she's got a whole following of listeners that are with us tonight, can you give any information in terms of a parenting plan to build in some precautionary language when you think there's an alienator on the other side? I just want to speak a little to those listeners.
That is so important in terms of the language that you use. Your father, your mother. I mean, if you just talk about mom or dad, isn't that much better than saying your father? Like, if the two parents are living in under one roof, you don't say your father, just say talk to dad about it or talk to mom about it. So, you know, there's those kinds of things. And you never, ever have your children carry messages from one parent to the other. You have to do that yourself. So within the parenting plan, you can talk about communication and how communication is to be handled. For instance, you could put a journal in your child's knapsack, and this can be handled very easily within the parenting plan in terms of the direction. But put a journal in the children's knapsack. It could have, you know, children's programming. It could have questions that one parent has of the other, go back and forth. It could talk about, in terms of the communication style, you know, the parenting plan, how to communicate with the other parent so that you diffuse the conflict and try to educate the parents in terms of the alienation. Because I think what parents often do is, there are some parents that are very bad parents. And Jill, I know we talked about this previously. Mm-hmm. The perianation is a horrible thing, and you've got parents whose mindset is dead set against one parent having a relationship with the other. Jill, correct me if I'm wrong, or Judge Lawrence, like, what do you think? I mean, there are some parents who are just so emotionally distraught that they're punishing the other parent, and I don't think whatever is in that parenting plan, you're going to be able to overcome the issues of parent alienation. That's where
you are absolutely right, Deborah. No matter what perfect parenting plan we come up with, there's always going to be that 20% of narcissistic, horrible people that are going to use their children's hearts, minds, and souls as weapons against the other parent. So those people will always exist. But I think Michelle is directing the question at a perfect parenting plan that reasonable people who can get beyond the emotion, can get beyond the legal, can really look at their child's best interests as their goal, that they can use this parenting plan to make happy, healthy children and not, as you say in the book, children of divorce.
Right. You know, one of the things that I tell my clients to do is think about all the dates that are important to them, your birthday, your children's birthday, the holidays. Like, think about all of those times and then discuss it with the other parent. Like, okay, it's almost like a negotiation. You know, my birthday is important to me, your birthday is important to you, so let's make sure that we have it in the plan so that if my birthday happens to be on your access time, that it's not a battle, you just give up that time. You know, those kinds of things, what happens on PD days or what happens on long weekends. So, you know, you can, if you have all of that in the parenting plan, you alleviate a battle. You're not.
Right. I was just talking about a little bit about, you know, precautionary language. But let's just say that I'm wondering how a coach might help in an alienating situation.
You know what? I think that a coach can't necessarily help in terms of, because I'm very cautious in terms of the information that I provide. So I will always refer my clients to parenting coordinators, parenting experts for that education part of it. You know, we can talk about the parenting side and what makes a good parent versus not such a strong parent. We can talk about how important it is, what the children's best interests are, what the children's Bill of Rights are. But in terms of the coach, I don't think that you should use the coach to help a parent deal with parent alienation. I really believe you need to go to specific experts, especially with alienation. I mean, it's such a sensitive issue, and the alienators obviously are very slick individuals. They know what they're doing. And
time is running out. I know that you work with groups of people going through a divorce, right?
Yeah.
So what I'm interested in knowing is, what have you learned over the years from working with these groups that surprised you?
You know what? It's interesting that you asked that question, because I've been doing a lot of research. I'm doing some work with the police and the firefighters, and I wanted to understand if there's a different mentality in certain occupations with respect to divorce, and even within certain religions, you know, if people that are extremely religious. But at the end of the day, everybody faces divorce in their own way. Divorce is a hugely emotional issue. And it doesn't matter what you believe in, what your occupation is, you are grieving the end of your marriage. People grieve in different ways. But I think that that's such an important lesson, is that everybody is hit by divorce in some way. So whereas I thought at the beginning, well, you know what, some people are kind of impervious and maybe they're not going to be affected all that badly. You know what, that's not true. I mean, everybody does grieve. And I think that that's really important to understand, is that divorce is going to affect you in some way. But I think what's critical is that people have to understand in terms of being better parents, because if you are too emotionally distraught, your children feel like they have to take care of you. And I think that that's something that I've learned, is that people often are so concerned about their own needs that they don't often think about what's going on around them, and the children often suffer.
Oh, yeah. When you make the child your therapist, you take away their ability to get their own needs met. They grow up learning that in order for you to be safe, you have to take care of everybody else.
Yeah.
You grow up, you have an adult relationship, and you don't ask your partner for what you need because you think you're not entitled to. You just got to take care of them. And you don't ask for what you need, you can't sustain a marriage, because then you just blow up one day because you're not getting anything.
Yeah.
You never gave the person a chance. It's a big problem for children of divorce.
It's a huge problem, and I think that that's one of the things that I've learned, is that people don't often take the time to really understand process and what they need to do and what they need to do for the family so that they can really move on. And I think that people oftentimes just want to move on, just want to race forward without doing the work that they need to do. You know, they want to jump into the next relationship without really understanding what went wrong in this relationship, what it is that they need to do for the next to create a healthy relationship the next time. And I think that that's some of the work that people don't do, that I'm learning that, you know, the divorce rate rises with each subsequent marriage. So what is it that they can do to prevent, you know, another relationship breakup? And I think that that's what's important, is that people don't necessarily do that introspective work.
And I know in your book, Michelle, The Good Karma Divorce, you're very clear that children are not resilient through divorce. And many people lumber through divorce with that thought in their head that their children are going to be okay. And they're not okay. Even in a good divorce situation, children are disturbed by what has gone on. So, Deborah, I want to ask you, what is the first step that you should take toward your children when you're going to enter into a divorce situation?
You know, I've done a lot of research with with individuals that are really at the forefront of the divorce arena and have done a significant amount of research, Bob Emery, Joan Kelly, Richard Warshak. And the first thing you need to do is take care of yourself emotionally. If you can take care of yourself and you feel strong, then you're a better parent, because one of the first things to go at the beginning of the divorce process is your parenting skills. If you don't feel good about yourself, you're not going to give your children a sense of security. So parents need to send out, you know, three messages: we love you very much, the divorce was not your fault, and a sense of security. And if you could do that and make the children feel secure, give them their space to grieve and let them ask questions. Too many parents don't tell the children about divorce. All of a sudden, one parent moves out of the home and, like, the children are confused. So I don't think children need to know the reasons behind the divorce. It's an adult issue. But they need to be kept apprised of what's happening and not have certain decisions just foisted upon them, because then they creates confusion. You know, like, children really want to know, where am I going to go to school? Where am I going to live? Can I still be with my friends? Like, they want to know all of this information, because they don't talk it out with other friends or therapists like we do. So you've got to really give your children all of those answers. You know, be prepared, and be prepared to talk to them. And that's what happens, is that oftentimes parents are afraid to have those conversations with their children. I mean, they are very, very tough conversations to have. And if you can't talk to your children about the divorce, then already you're starting out with a problem.
I would add on to that for all the listeners that it's not, and I know you're not saying this either, but just to make it really emphasized, it's not just one conversation you have with your children. You have a conversation with them anytime they want.
I think it's ongoing.
They need to. Ongoing, right, Jill? And every year, commensurate with their development. If they're young children, up till about the age of 10, no matter what, because of their brain development, they will blame themselves for the divorce.
Right.
You need to tell them always, this is not your fault, this is a big people problem. When they're teenagers, they will look to assign blame, and you'll see more anger. And you have to talk to them in a completely different way that really is talking to them. You never tell them a truth that would serve to hurt them. Many parents in my courtroom say, well, I think that they should know the truth about their mother or the truth about their father, even though it's going to crush their ability to feel safe in the world if they're not safe with one parent. So that speech, I say to the parents, research it. Look at other people's speech. Rehearse it. Write it down. It may be the single most important talk you ever have with your kids.
Absolutely, and there's no second chances. So you want to make sure that you handle this conversation really well, because it's a life-altering decision.
Well, for me, I would reframe the not second chances. You may have screwed it up. You may not have done it right so far. Today's a new day. You could go to, After I gave a talk in San Francisco, the mother went out and said to her son, "I'm sorry I ever maligned your father. I want to tell you it's not your fault, da-da-da-da-da." This is the first time they had a civil conversation in years. The child was ready to get involved in drugs and alcohol. It's never really too late.
You're right.
To try and make a major effort and even let your child know, you know what, I could have done this better. I should have talked to you before. And they're sitting there thinking, yeah, at least they know how I was hurt.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I often send my clients to different parenting experts to help them develop that script, to give them that sense of confidence in terms of what it is that they need to say. One of the things that I did, actually, and this is long before the smart divorce, it's when I, at the beginning of my divorce process, is I went to a child psychiatrist so I could understand my children's experience through divorce. And I could attribute, you know, they were young. They were 1, 3, and 7 at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I wanted to understand, like, developmentally, what their behavior was as a result of divorce and what their behavior was as a result of where they were in their life stage. And I think that that was really helpful to me, is going to the child psychiatrist so I could ask lots of questions and to help me understand how to answer some of their questions as well in a child-focused way.
Well, I want to tell you guys, I've had an amazing time with you both tonight, and I can't believe we're 3 minutes until the show is over. And, Deborah, I want to ask you if you'll come back again.
Absolutely.
And visit us. I would love to have you, because there's so many things we could cover, and it's so valuable if you're thinking about a divorce or going through one or still dealing with the aftermath of one, that you take your time and you read Deborah's book, The Smart Divorce, and understand what's happening to you. Deborah, where can they get your book?
They could buy it wherever books are sold, Barnes & Noble in Canada, Chapters, Indigo, Amazon.com. Wherever books are sold, on many websites, the book is available.
And if
they want to contact me, I've got a website,
yeah,
www.thesmartdivorce.com. They can email info@thesmartdivorce.com for any questions that they might have. And there's also the blog that they can access off the website.
And, Deborah, you're available in the United States as well as a consultant, are you not?
I am. I consult with people across North America. So if you'd like to set up a consultation, you can email me again at info@thesmartdivorce.com. You could call me at 905-695-0270 and set up a teleconference. I actually consult with many individuals via Skype or, you know, just on a landline. And people are finding it very helpful. And because I'm so connected across North America with lawyers, mental health professionals, parenting experts, doesn't matter where you are, I will always do that research to refer my clients to individuals, to the right individuals that they need.
Outstanding. Yep. Deborah, I thank you so much for this wonderful book, and it is going to also help in the fight to change divorce culture across the world. So I encourage everybody to get the book. And speaking of books, my co-host, Judge Michelle Arantz, has a great book, The Good Karma Divorce, and she has a book signing at the bookstall in Winnetka, Illinois, which is 811 Elm Street, on September 27th at 7 o'clock. So everybody, all you guys up in the Chicagoland area, get out there to the bookstall and see Michelle. She is an amazing person, an amazing judge, a great author, and she would love to talk about divorce and what goes on in courtrooms all across America and how we should change it.
And what about The Look of Love? Are we signing off without talking about The Look of Love? Are
you,
you
know,
kidding
I don't
me?
Like to talk about myself, Michelle.
Are you kidding me? This is the seminal book on parent alienation. And as I say to Jill all the time, this is the extreme example. People do it on a much smaller level than this book, but you need to read this book to make sure it doesn't even happen on the smaller level. I mean,
well,
you know, that's how I feel about it, Jill. So
thank you. And both of our books are available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, our own websites, thegoodkarma.com and thelookoflovebook.com. And then, of course, Deborah's book is The Smart Divorce. So three great girls with three great books. You should read them all. It'll change your life. We love you all for listening, and I thank you both for being here. And we'll contact you soon, Deborah, for another date.
And Deborah, thanks for making my life a lot easier on the bench.
That's what being smart about divorce is.
Yes, thank you.
Thank
you on behalf of Cook County.
Thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Bye-bye.
Have a great night, ladies.
Hello?
Your smile can't disguise the look of love.